You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hey, this is Lee Baucom, and this is the Save the Marriage Podcast. I welcome you. I'm glad you're here. You're here because you're working on something with your relationship, wherever that might be, and I'm here to give you some advice about that, and I'm here to share with you some thoughts today about fear. Now, the reason I chose fear is because it seems like that is the dominant emotion when there is a problem with a relationship. Fear grips us. And fear does one of two things. It often either paralyzes us or it pushes us into actions that are counterproductive. So I tend to watch as people come into my office on which they fall into. You may have watched animals around you and how they deal with being scared, right? And so in our yard, we often have rabbits. And what I notice is that one of the defenses of a rabbit is to just freeze, not move in any direction, fearing that any action will lead to something grabbing it, right? And then we have this group of birds, the starlings or the blackbirds, that whenever you go out, they're startled and they start flying erratically left and right, and a whole pack of them just moving around and around only to settle usually in the exact same tree or some other tree that is putting them at just as much risk as the other one. In other words, they keep acting, they keep moving, but in no way that helps them. The reason that this is important is because we kind of share those responses with animals. We tend to do one of two things when fear comes our way. We either freeze or we become frantic. We don't do a good job of choosing a clear place, because fear tends to be one of those things that we're not used to dealing with. And what we want most to do is not feel fear, to get away from fear, to avoid fear. And yet, fear is an indicator of pointing us in a direction of importance. So let's just kind of think about this. You know, if your relationship didn't matter to you in the least, would you have any fear about it? I know that there are people in my life that, you know, if I didn't see them again, if they didn't call me, that would be okay. I mean, it's not that I want them to, but it's just that relationship is not so important that it would get me upset to not have them in my life. In fact, it's quite the opposite. The more important the relationship, the bigger the fear response tends to be, the biological fear response tends to be. And that's true with fear a lot of times, that the bigger it is, the bigger the issue, the more important it is, which is odd because what we tend to do is try to not feel fear, try to tamp that down, try to avoid it. And yet it's only an indicator of how important that is for us. Okay, so let's just talk for a minute about fear in kind of a biological and a psychological way. First, fear is a natural emotion. We are wired to have that fear. It's just tied into our survival. The interesting thing is that then our psychology, that's the biology of it, but psychologically, we then try to avoid feeling any of those fears. But deep in our brain is a wiring. You know, if you look at a lot of animals, it's as if they are always running on fear. The rabbits out in my yard, they're nibbling the grass and they're constantly looking around them. Why are they always in fear? Because they are always prey. Rabbits have no predatory instinct whatsoever. They are not out to get anything. They couldn't if they wanted to. And so all they're trying to do is make sure they're not attacked. They're fairly defenseless, and so they have to make sure that they're always on the defense. That's wired into them, is that fear response. And we share that peace with them, right? We share that deep place of that's tied to survival. Here's the thing that we often fail to recognize. We humans have an extra sensitive reader on fear. We have an extra sensitive fear threat notification system. And the reason we have that is because that is what made our genes survive in much more hostile, dangerous times. There was a time when we needed fear to be constantly on guard because that shadow right behind that tree might have been a saber-toothed tiger about to grab us. And anyone who had a less sensitive setting on their fear response became dinner. And so over time, selective process meant that we are overset for a fear response. Our brains are selectively overly sensitive to a threat. That's great when you're on the savanna or in the jungle or at some place that's really risky. It's not so great when the threats are not so much about life, but about our enjoyment of life. And it's suddenly those same old primitive responses tend to get us in trouble. So I want you just for a minute to think of your brain as having three different layers, one wrapped on top of each other, and we're going to go to the most primitive layer, the base of your brain, which has been called the lizard brain, the reptilian brain. The lizard brain is kind of a poetic way of thinking about it. The reptilian brain is all about looking for the threats. The amygdala and the hippocampus are the two major parts of that. Amygdala constantly looking on the environment for anything that might be a threat, and the hippocampus storing that information so it's instantly readable and accessible to the brain system to see, is that really a threat? So the lizard brain is only about threat. It's all it cares about. When I was a teenager, I was at camp one summer. My parents had sent me to this camp, and I don't even think they realized how primitive it was, because our cabins, as they were called, were really just big pieces of canvas over a 2x4 structure, and we were on cots that was on a wooden floor. And in order to get our food to cook, we had to hike about a mile, 2 miles. In my mind, it was about 20 miles, but I think it was probably a mile or two, to the main house, pick it up out of a garbage can where and it wasn't used for garbage, but it was where they stored our food. And each group just had a garbage can marked to them, and we would pull out the bag and take it up and cook. And oh, if we wanted water, we had to hike that same 1 to 2 miles down. And so it was a rough camp. And we had two counselors who were watching after us, two young men who were watching after us. And so one was always with us. But in the evenings, they would take turns going down and hanging out with the half of the other counselors. And they would just kind of take turns through the week. And so one night I was lying on my cot along with my cot mates, all my cabin mates, I guess. And we heard one of them yelling to the other. Well, the other happened to be, and this was, you know, back in the day of boomboxes. He was listening to his music in his tent. It was some way away from us. And he couldn't hear the yelling. And so we heard it. It woke us from our light sleep. And we went out and we started towards the counselor saying, what's going on? And he said, stop. Don't come any closer. Go get the other person. And so we went and got him. And then we were told to go back to our cabin, otherwise known as the tent, that had the slats in the floor, to find that what had happened is that there was a rattlesnake in the path, and it wouldn't move, and it was threatening. And so the two of them managed to capture the rattlesnake. And the next day, we were able to go to the main house and visit that snake. And this was a very important moment in my development, because I remember it so well. There was that snake in the cage. And the cage was, you know, it was just a little fencing, right? And so all it would have really is kind of like chicken wire. And so it kept the snake in there, but that snake could see us and smell us and sense us. And I began to experiment to see what would happen if I got close. And what I noticed is as I walked closer, the rattling got louder. It would until it was unavoidable. And as I walked away, it would die away. I walked closer. As I walked away, it calmed down and got more excited as I came toward it and away from it. When I walked away from it, it calmed down. I got closer. I was a threat, and it was looking at me as that threat and trying to decide what to do about me. If I got close enough, me and the other boys who were happy to torture this poor snake, it would strike the edge of that cage, and by midday, it had a raw nose from striking that cage. Couldn't get to us, but we sure enjoyed taunting it and making it strike the cage. Now, here's the important part of this. That reptile had no emotions towards me. It was only about threat assessment. Was I big enough to take down, or did it need to get away from me? Could it threaten me enough that I would step away, or did it need to strike? That was all it was thinking about. And when I say thinking, that's a pretty primitive place to think that all it is a threat. It had no ill feelings towards me. When I stepped away, it was fine to let me go. No anger, no ill feelings, just being a snake. Okay, let's compare that to animals that have one other new layer of brain, the limbic system. The limbic system, or the mammalian brain, is the part that leads warm-blooded animals and some other animals to want to be together in a pack. There has to be some emotional connection for that to happen. There has to be some affinity for each other for that to happen. Well, snakes might get together. I know there are dens of snakes, but what we know about that is they're basically there to try to huddle up and keep warm. It's not that they like each other. They go separate ways as soon as it's warm enough for them to disappear. But there are warm-blooded animals that stay together all the time. Whales that stay in a pod and want to be with each other. So you think about this, let's say in terms of a dog, right? You have a dog, and you can tell a dog actually can have emotions. A dog can have anger. And over time, an abused dog might stay in its place because it knows it better in order to be cared for and fed and all those things. But over time, it might lash out in anger. And when if you've ever seen a dog lash out, you can see the anger. Or how about an elephant? You hear stories from India and other places where that elephant has been kept cooped up and abused over its years and finally one day goes into a tantrum and destroys things. There's emotion to it, that emotion that can be controlled, but emotion to it. So that's the mammalian, the limbic brain that adds emotions to those feelings of threat. So when we have these feelings associated with being fearful, those feelings, those emotions aren't just about survival. We can begin to have thoughts attached to them, which brings us to the top part of our brain, the neocortex. That neocortex is what we're most proud of as humans, you know, where we have language and reasoning, a capacity of deciding whether something is good and right or bad and wrong. And we have all those judgments and thoughts and feelings. And all those come together that combine how we feel and is there a threat. And so our brain is literally from the ground up wired for fear responses, looking for the threats that then go into this feeling of fear that then go into our thoughts. But our thoughts can filter down to the bottom also. It goes both ways. Think for just a moment if you've ever had this experience. You're driving down the expressway, right? And you round a curve and you see that traffic has come to a standstill. And without even thinking about it, you slam on the brake. And you come to a stop just short of the car in front of you. Your primitive brain has just protected your body. Your primitive brain has stopped you from having an accident. But then comes the rush of emotions. You might be exhilarated that you didn't wreck, or you might be frightened that had happened and angry that the people in front of you had stopped for no reason. And then suddenly comes the rush of thoughts. Boy, I ought to be more careful when I'm around in the bend. How dare those crazy people up there? Why are they doing construction today of all days? Who would do that in rush hour? And on it goes. And so we have an immediate fear response followed with an emotional response followed with thoughts about that. The problem is those thoughts can keep us stuck because, as I've talked about before, we confuse thoughts with reality. We as humans tend to slip into thinking that what we're thinking about is true, that what we're thinking about is reality. And I've talked about the thought recognition, the span of thought recognition, and from on one end of that span is where every thought is a reality. That we see people who do this called mental illness, that whatever pops in their head, they think is true 100% of the time. On the other hand, would be people who think whatever pops in their head, they realize it's just a thought. It's just a thought. And we all live, really, most of us live in the in-between, where when we're having a good day, we're aware that that's just a thought in my head, no big deal. But when we're not feeling so good, when we're a little tapped out of energy, when there's a crisis at hand, then we start thinking that the thought is real, that we get stuck in that thought. And so one of the rubrics of dealing with fears is remembering that thoughts are just that. They're just thoughts, pumped up full of emotion. And the starting point might be that feeling of threat from deep down inside, but they're still just thoughts. Now, the thoughts focus around three different areas. There are three types of fears that we all humans have. The one is, I won't have enough. Think about how this is built into our survival. I won't have enough. Two is, I won't be good enough. And three is, I won't be loved enough. Okay, I won't have enough is that desperation we might feel, that we might just not have enough food or warmth or money or name it, people around us, whatever it is. We won't have enough. And that shortage, that scarcity can get into us and cause us to chase after things long after it's necessary. Now, a marriage crisis can bring that on. I won't have enough money to survive the way I've been surviving. I won't have a house to live in the way I've been living. I won't have a retirement the way I imagined. All those thoughts get us into a fearful place. They drive the fear already, and we get stuck. How about I won't be good enough? If one of your thoughts is, I have failed at this, you can tell me clearly how you've been gripped by that fear. And I can tell you, you have been gripped by the fear of not being good enough. So you've got to remember that that's not necessarily true. We can do that to ourselves. We can say, oh gosh, if I were just better, then I wouldn't be here. And I can tell you that that's just not the case. It's not about being good enough. Okay, how about not being loved enough? Is there anything else, any crisis that brings us closer to that fear of not being good enough than not being loved enough than a marriage crisis, than a relationship crisis? Because that person that we want most to love us has moved away from us. And that can trigger lots of actions. You know, I've seen people that were so fearful that they won't be loved enough that they go find somebody else to try to love them, only to find that that's either a toxic or an unhealthy relationship. Letter after letter comes to me and says, you know, in the middle of this crisis, you know, I gave in and I had a relationship with somebody else. And I know where that came from. It came from the fear of not being loved enough. Not long ago, I got a letter from somebody saying, you know, there's something, I just need somebody to love on me so that I feel okay. And I knew what fear had gripped them. And the key to understanding this is recognizing those fears are caught up in thoughts. And that when we realize they are thoughts, we can relax a little bit. Because one of the things that's true about fear is it's almost always about future. We almost always are pulling from the future. There's an acronym for fear that I really like. There are a lot of acronyms, and you may have heard the one, false evidence appearing real. That's one definition of fear. Another one is this, future events appearing real. Future events appearing real, that we think that something out there that we have no way of knowing how it's going to go, we've already decided the outcome. We've already decided how horrible this is going to be. We've already decided this is going to destroy us. And so you get caught up in that message, that thought, instead of realizing that it's just thinking about the future and pulling it in a future you don't even know how it's going to go yet. You don't even know how it's going to lead because you're so caught up in the thought of that. Which leads to the next acronym, future events already ruined. We've already played out how life is just going to go bad now, right? We've got to be careful to recognize that's a thought. That's where our head is telling us this, what's not true. So remember that the thoughts are going to get focused around those fears that I won't have enough, I won't be good enough, and I won't be loved enough. And yet, almost always, those are false. Life will go on, no matter what happens with a relationship, and that's the place that you begin to do reality testing. Life will go on. It may be different. In fact, I would say to you, if you're in a marriage crisis, it needs to be different. You don't want to go back to where you've been. And that's what fear tries to get us to do, to stay where we've been, to try to get back to somewhere else. See, we avoid the feeling of fear instead of dealing with the thoughts that lead to the fear. And when we avoid the feeling of fear, we're trying to get to the same old place. We're trying to get to a place. So another acronym is a frantic effort to avoid reality. It's a frantic effort to avoid reality, The reality is things have to change. We want to get back to, and so many times people say, I just want to get back to where we were, to which I say, no, you don't, because where you were got you to where you are. You need a whole new relationship. You need something different than where you've been. So give up on where you've been. Leave that shore behind and go towards a new land. You may not know what that land's going to be, but you've got to leave that behind and not let fear convince you that you've got to try to get back to where you were. Where you were has not gotten you to where you need to be. So now you have to find a new path. To convince yourself is to start with the beginning step of what you do with fear. So what do you do with fear? What are the antidotes to fear? Let's talk just for a minute about the antidotes. The number one antidote to fear is action. Action begins to calm us down when we move towards the fear instead of avoiding it. You know, what we generally do when we feel fear is we take action to get away from it. But what if we say, wow, the fear is telling me that I need to start moving. I need to start getting in gear. I need to start taking action. But there are some things that need to be true about the action. One, it needs to be appropriate. A lot of times people start lashing out and they start returning a spouse's frustrations with anger. And so their approach in taking action is to go on the offensive. Or they take action and they run to somebody else. Or they take action and they just begin to act in crazy ways, begging and pleading and manipulating and doing all those actions. Those are not appropriate actions. Those are actions, but they're desperate actions. Actions that move you toward resolution are always non-reactionary. That you decide the action you're going to take instead of reacting to what's going on. Also, they're based on a successful system or an approach. That's part of what I try to provide in my Save the Marriage system. The Save the Marriage system that I have at Save the Marriage is about having a measured approach, knowing what you're headed for, knowing how you're going to do it, what actions to take. That's why I provide that, because in the midst of the fear, you need to have some way of stepping towards what you want, some way of deciding where you want to go that is not reacting to what a spouse is doing, saying, or being, but choosing a path that you know is based on your own ethics and based on what you think is best for the relationship. Another place you can kind of measure your actions is what I call the three C's. Are you calm, constant, and consistent? Calm is a good one. Now, calm doesn't mean that all the fears are gone and everything's hunky-dory and you're just going to pretend. Calm is finding a place of solitude, of saying to yourself, I am doing the right thing and I'm going to do it calmly. I don't know the outcome, so I'm not going to get wrapped up in the outcome, but I'm going to do my work. I'm going to do my actions calmly. I'm going to do it constantly, which means that I'm not going to do something today in my plan and then wait 2 weeks to do something else or 2 months or not do anything for 6 months and then wonder why I haven't built any connection. And the last one is consistent, that we don't keep changing approaches. So one day I'm trying to connect. The next day I'm trying to make them jealous. The next day I'm going to plead and beg. Then I'm going to try to connect again, and I'm going to make them jealous. And all that does is make us look A, desperate, B, inconsistent, and C, a little crazy. And so we have to find some ways of being calm, constant, and consistent with those actions. So you have a plan, and you work that plan. One of the phrases my wife uses often is consult your plan, not your feelings. Consult your plan, not how your emotions are running the day, but how you're feeling. Your plan. Work your plan. Okay, what else can you do? You can breathe. Another great antidote to fear is breathing. Now, I don't just mean like breathe in and out, but belly breathing. Belly breathing is a way of signaling to that primitive part of the brain that everything is okay. There is no threat. Everything is okay. Now, you can convince it of that because you can take over your breathing pattern. Remember, we have the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. We have the automatic systems in our body. You don't have to tell your heart to beat, or you don't have to say you need to breathe. Does that automatically. but you can choose to take over the breathing part. That's a system you can choose to take over by belly breathing. If you are not familiar with belly breathing, I want you to find a flat surface, couch, floor, bed, somewhere that you can lie down in privacy and put a hand over your belly button and another hand over your breastbone. Okay, so now you want to practice breathing in so that the only hand that moves is the hand over your belly button. The hand over your chest stays completely still. That's belly breathing. If you're not familiar, that's what they teach you in yoga or in meditation and lots of martial arts, other places where you learn to breathe appropriately in ways that calm the system down. And because of the way we're taught to stand up straight and hold in our stomach and do other things, we don't breathe appropriately, which only jacks up the amount of adrenaline flowing through our body, which signals our body and our brain that something is wrong. There is a threat. We need to be worried. Belly breathing does the opposite. It tells our brain that everything is okay. Stop dropping all that adrenaline into the blood. Everything's okay. When we do that, we speak to the most primitive part of our brains to convince it that everything's okay. The break of your primitive brain is belly breathing. The accelerator is chest breathing. So you want to check to see which you're doing. Then you want to take care of yourself because fear feeds off adrenaline. And guess what some things are that feed adrenaline? Carbohydrates, including sugar, particularly sugar. Not getting enough rest, not getting an exercise that works off some of that adrenaline, not eating appropriate foods, not taking care of ourselves. So when I say take care of yourself, make sure you're eating healthy foods, make sure you're getting the rest you need, and make sure you're getting some exercise. That helps to tamp down that response in the brain. The more tired we are, the less well our diet is, the more we're loading up with the bad stuff, the more we're spiking adrenaline into our blood system, and the more we're going to feel like we're on defense. Now, you're going to tell me that what you want to eat is the comfort food. And I'm going to tell you that you can do that, but that's only adding to the fear response that's already in you. Okay, so take care of yourself is an antidote to the fear response. Being in the present moment is an antidote. When you find yourself saying, what if, what happens, what if, what if, what if, when what's dominate your life, what's going to happen, or whys, the why question, why is this happening, only gets us fixated on trying to figure it out. Figuring it out usually leads to the next place of going, so what's going to happen? So don't play the future game and don't rehash the past constantly. Stay in the present moment. Focus on what's going on now. Focus on finding some places of connecting now, and that's going to be an antidote to the fear. Okay, the other thing is I don't want you to wait to be fearless to take action. There is no such thing as fearless. A number of years back, I was talking with my son's Cub Scout troop. I was one of the den leaders, and so in that conversation, I heard them. They were talking about courage. And I said, hey, what do you think is brave? What they were talking about, I can't remember what it was, but police or fire department or someone who they were brave. And I said, what does it mean to be brave? And they said, you don't have any fear. And I said, no, when you don't have any fear, that's just acting. That's just doing stuff. That's just taking action. Being brave or courageous is choosing to take action in spite of the fear. Not waiting for the fear to subside, but choosing to take action in spite of the fear. Whenever we are motivated to move in the direction of something, even though we fear it, we're acting courageously, which is why I say when you're working to save your marriage, that to me is courageous, brave work. Not everybody does it. A lot of people say, you know what? That's just too hard. I'm not going to try it. I'm not going to be able to make progress. I'm not going to do this. So I'm not going to do it. But here is the last piece I want you to hear. The more fear you're having, the more important it is to you. The more fear that's there, all that's doing is indicating how important that is to you. think back to the days of dating. You know, if there was somebody that was you saw and you weren't interested in that person, you could have a conversation because there was nothing important about it. But if you saw someone that attracted you, saw someone that you thought there was might be something there, that it began to be a big deal, then we get tongue-tied and we get nervous and we feel the flutters in our stomach and we get all nervous because it suddenly becomes more important to us. The things that are most important to us are what draw our fear the most. They're not indicators that we should then avoid it. Quite the opposite. They set our GPS system. They give us a new compass reading. The compass reading is instead of staying away from the fear, it's moving towards the fear. As long as you do it in those actions that are appropriate, that are non-reactionary, that are based on a system that works, and that follow the constant calm, constant, consistent pattern, CCC. When you do that, suddenly you're moving against the fear. Suddenly you're finding ways of addressing it. Don't avoid the fear. Understand that fear is based in a survival mechanism that goes back to primitive days and that is compounded by your thoughts. And remind yourself, a thought is just a thought, that you can take action, that you can breathe through this, that you can take care of yourself. Stay in the present moment. And don't wait to take action until there's no fear. Choose to take action in spite of that. That's the bravery you have. Act bravely. Act with courage. Step out and take a risk. Okay, so now is your turn to respond. What do you think about what I'm saying? Do you have other pieces of how you deal with your fear, of understanding how you do that? I'd love to hear about it. Leave it in the comments section below this. If you're listening on the blog, you can just leave it there. If you're listening on iTunes or Stitcher or one of the other systems of listening to the podcast, on one of those other podcasters, you can go and leave a comment just by going to SaveTheMarriageBlog.com. SaveTheMarriageBlog.com. That'll get you right there, and you can leave a comment there. Or you can email. Email me at podcast@savethemarriage.com. That's a good way of letting me know what you would love to hear about in the future. That's not how can you tell me about your situation and hope that I can do some counseling with you. That's not how I do that. We have other mechanisms for that. That's not it. This is simply about what would you like to hear about? What would you like me to cover that would help you move forward with that? So email me at podcast@savethemarriage.com. Also, you can leave us a voicemail. My podcast number is 4, the number 4, help, the number 4, help, and then 44132. 4, help, 44132. Or you can just dial 443-574-4132. That's 443-574-4132. Country code is 1. We're in the U.S. So let us know what you would like to hear about. Leave me a message. Let me know that. Also, if you are interested in the Kindle book, you can find my Kindle book at SaveTheMarriage.com/Kindle. That's SaveTheMarriage.com/Kindle. Now, I love you being here. I so appreciate it. I hope you will spread the word. If you got something out of this, please give me a good rating in the iTunes area, if that's how you listen, or leave a good comment, or post this on Facebook. There's lots you could get out of this, even if it's not a marriage crisis. So somehow spread the word. Let people know so that we can get more people the help that they need. The only way that I'm going to get more people in on help is if you help me spread the word. You're my ambassador. If you've gotten something out of it, please leave that. So until next week, this is Lee Balkum wishing you the best as you continue to work to save your marriage.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage Podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.